The Eurovision Song Contest is primarily, and if we're honest, correctly, regarded as a ludicrous pageant of dreadful and/or baffling pop music. But Eurovision also heaves with political and diplomatic subtext. Outside World Cups and Olympic Games, there are few better opportunities than Eurovision for a nation to project itself. 182 million people watched the 2019 contest. Many more besides would have seen highlights and lowlights in their social media feeds, and not only in the 39 countries which compete. The cancellation of last year's Eurovision Song Contest due to the COVID-19 pandemic prompted an amount of merriment of the every cloud slash silver lining variety. But it's back. This year's Eurovision Song Contest takes place in Rotterdam next Saturday, preceded by semi-finals this Tuesday and Thursday. While this is first and foremost good news for fans of cheesy songs, overwrought performances, and hosts with suspiciously gleaming teeth reading leaden, laboured dialogue like someone is pointing a gun at them, it is also terrifically exciting for those who appreciate Eurovision as a sort of annual soft power tournament. What are the do's and don'ts of making the most of the national branding possibilities of Eurovision? Who is good at it and who isn't? And will anybody ever vote for the UK again? This is the Foreign Desk.
I've been covering, you know, Eurovision for Monaco for years now, and I've been to, I believe, 7 of them, and 2 of them were in Sweden. And I have to say, that's the country where I have the most fun covering. They are a powerhouse when it comes to music.
Paulo de Carvalho's song is completely apolitical. It's a love ballad talking about the end of a relationship. So it is quite ironic that a song about a breakup leads to the fall of one of Europe's longest dictatorships.
It's the biggest global entertainment brand, one of them certainly, in the world. It's the most watched annual entertainment show of any kind, I mean sporting events included, on an annual basis. And it has a reach across the globe. I mean, it's extraordinary how many people tune in to watch it.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Monocle's senior correspondent and much more to the point of this episode, Monocle 24's Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, there is a lot to discuss where Eurovision is concerned, as hopefully the rest of this programme will demonstrate. This is Monocle 24's extremely serious, award-winning foreign affairs programme, and I'm just furiously overcompensating right now for the fact that we're about to do an entire episode on the Eurovision Song Contest. But I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about the do's and the don'ts of using Eurovision to project your nation. Clearly, some countries have been really good at it, and some have been quite the opposite. So let's start with the do's, if you will. The first country you want to talk about who have been historically really good at making Eurovision work for them.
I have to say Sweden. And there's many reasons for that, Andrew. First of all, I've been to Sweden twice for Eurovision, to Malmo and to Stockholm. They were my favourite cities because, you know, when the city kind of breathes Eurovision, mm-hmm. It was everywhere and people, they genuinely love there and they take it very seriously. They even have, you know, a contest before Melody Festivalen to choose their own entry. And not only that, even when you look on television, in Sweden, they have some level of mockery of the event, like we have here in the UK, but also respect. It's not just about mockery. And in fact, we actually have a clip from the 2016 event where the hosts Måns Zelmerlöw and Petra Mede, they sing a song called Love, Love, Peace, Peace, where they talk about all the Eurovision clichés, but in a very nice way. Let's have a listen.
Let the song begin with passion, let the wind begin to blow. You can break the rules of fashion, and your chance to win shall grow. Look into the TV camera.
Sweden there, consecrating themselves as the default Eurovision nation. Fernando, before we contemplate the other two you wanted to isolate who have done it well, what values do you think Sweden is projecting when it adopts Eurovision like this? What is it about Eurovision that Sweden wants the world to see in Sweden?
Well, One interesting thing that in this ceremony as well, they wanted to portray Sweden as a very open and welcoming country. And they did that in a lovely way, because we all know, and we're going to talk a bit more about that, that the LGBT community loves Eurovision. But to be honest, it's not really sometimes shown on the big screen because, you know, we're dealing with the whole of Europe. Mm-hmm. And some countries are more conservative than others. And I believe in this ceremony, they had a gay kiss during one of the performances and they made a big deal out of it.
Moving along to your second choice of who does it well, and I guess this is an illustration of how a country can use Eurovision to project a different idea of itself than one that often appears in the news. This is Israel. How has Israel effectively used Eurovision to project a different idea of itself?
I think Israel does that in a very smart way, projecting their soft power. I chose one victory back in 1998, where I believe the event was hosted here in the UK. Dana International, a transgender woman, won with a song called Diva. There were a lot of backlash, even in Israel. Some communities were completely against that. And remember, that was 1998. Most countries here in Europe didn't have gay marriage. I think that was a really kind of turning point at Eurovision. And of course, it's a good excuse to play as well.
Let's do that.
Viva Maria, viva Victoria, Afrodita. Viva la diva, viva Victoria, Cleopatra.
Just now occurs to me that my subconscious had worked very hard these last 23 years to drive that from my memory, and now it's back there,
it's
Fernando,
back.
And it's not going anywhere in a hurry. Your final choice as a country that uses Eurovision well is a country which is tipped in some quarters to bring it home this year.
Italy. They've been out of Eurovision for quite a few years, in the 90s as well. But the more recent reason why I chose Italy, I love that they always sing in Italian. It's a beautiful language.
It is a beautiful language.
They're proud of it. And I chose also Italy because when they won back in 1990, they won with a song called Insieme 92, or Together 92, which was talking about the creation of the European Union back in 1992. Mm-hmm. And it was a song for Europe to be united. And I think that's an important message today, and was quite important at the time. It even won the event. We have a clip of this beautiful song by Toto Cutugno, Insieme 92.
That's Italy trying to teach the continent, if not the world, to sing in 1992. Fernando, that does move us along to what I suspect is going to be the more fun part of this conversation, which is the countries which, with the best will in the world, never quite succeed in making Eurovision work for them. First up, we have Russia.
Of course, I have to mention Russia. I've been to a few of the finals of the Eurovision, and I have to say, sometimes when it's the Russian entry, they are booed on stage.
And we say hello to Alsau sitting in Moscow. Could we please have your top points, please?
Hello, Copenhagen.
And that's not because the act is so bad.
That's got a bit to do with it.
Perhaps a bit in a couple of years. But again, I was talking about how the Eurovision Song Contest is very much an LGBT-friendly mm-hmm. event. And Russia has a terrible... They are terrible when it comes to LGBT rights. And even when they've hosted the event in 2009... There's been a lot of controversy surrounding that. But Andrew, if I may end up on a positive note, I think their entry this year, for example, we have Maniza with Russian Woman. She's kind of a feminist. She's pro-LGBT, pro-women, pro-refugees. I'm not sure if all Russian politicians do like her, actually. So I think it's important to have Russia at the event and perhaps talk about certain issues that would never be discussed if it wasn't for such an event. So it's don'ts, but with some touches of do's as well.
Fernando, as we continue with our rundown of the countries that have not used Eurovision terribly successfully to further their image in the world, we do need, I think, with due melancholy, to contemplate the one country which has perhaps in recent years beclowned itself more than any other on the Eurovision stage, and that is the one from which we are broadcasting, which is the United Kingdom. What is the problem here? Is it just that the songs all suck? And also, I think this is a thing I do think becomes a factor, which is that there is a perception among many of the other Eurovision nations who take this incredibly seriously, that the British mostly think of it as a reason to get together one Saturday night a year, have a few drinks and laugh at foreigners.
Which officially shouldn't be a problem. But the thing is, as I was saying, Sweden also has a touch of mockery, but it can't just be mockery. That's the problem with the UK. It's a shame to say the UK because they had a long history. I mean, look at the previous winners. You have Bucks Fizz, you know, we have Brotherhood of Man, or even Katrina and the Waves more recently. I think their last win. I think it's like the 1966 World Cup. They keep saying, oh yes, yeah, we won back in 1997. But I think there's a little bit of an arrogance towards it.
Arrogance from the British, surely you just...
Shocking, right? But I chose a track from 2003, which of course got 0 points, nil point, because it was so bad.
Who was this again?
This is Gemini with the horrible Crybaby.
That absolutely sucks and indeed blows. And the live performance of it on the evening did it no favours. As you say, however, they did rack up the nil point, which is always a great and glorious moment when someone manages to go through the entire continent and not find anybody willing to throw them the smallest of bone. Finally, then, before we go on with the show, is there one single lesson you can impart to any country that has Eurovision coming up and is thinking, you know what? Let's give it a real proper crack this year. Let's really go out there before this immense global audience and sell ourselves. What would you advise them?
Well, I think you should hire very good producers. We're seeing this a little bit this year, Andrew, because smaller nations, they're sending, in my opinion, this year, the better songs. For example, we see countries like Malta, Lithuania, even Iceland, countries that never won Eurovision. And I feel they're treating very seriously. They're very sharp, good beats, you know, and they could win. And I think it would matter a lot for their countries if it wins. It's going to attract more money, more tourists, perhaps. I'm sure next year the world will be open. So that's my tip. I think the smaller countries are doing everything they can to win. And I think the bigger countries shouldn't underestimate them.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Monocle 24's Eurovision Desk Chief, thank you for joining us. We will have more from you later in the show. Anybody who doubts the real-world political potence of Eurovision is clearly unfamiliar with what transpired in Portugal in 1974. Here's Monocle 24's and Portugal's Carlota Rebelo with the story of the Carnation Revolution.
As far as Eurovision songs go, there are several reasons why they might become iconic. Perhaps it's all down to a catchy chorus, a drawn-out saxophone solo for no apparent reason, or even an over-the-top performance by dancers wearing a nation's traditional clothes. Yes, I am looking at you, Poland, and your butter churners in 2014. But I bet that starting a revolution, which eventually leads to the fall of a fascist regime, wasn't one of the reasons at the top of your list. It's April 1974, and we're in Brighton when the 19th Eurovision Song Contest comes to a close. This is an eventful occasion. To start with, it wasn't even meant to happen in the UK. The BBC only agreed to host the event after Luxembourg, having won both previous years, refused to incur the costs of staging it yet again. Then, this is the year that the world is forever changed, and we're introduced to Sweden's most famous quartet, ABBA, who have just won with their chart-topping track Waterloo. But for humble Portugal, this year's entry would change its history forever, even if the actual song ended up at a shared last spot with only 3 points. For over 4 decades now, Portugal had been under the Estado Novo regime, a dictatorship led by António Oliveira Salazar. By this stage, people's discontent with the authoritarian regime was palpable. There was no freedom of speech or thought. The state's political police could arrest you for conspiracy simply based on a tip and with no facts. And core issues such as ending Portugal's colonial empire and granting Angola and Mozambique their independence were all contributing to the quiet calls for democracy. But a coup wouldn't be an easy feat to achieve. Activists knew they had to get it right, as they wouldn't be a second time. Getting caught simply wasn't an option. To be sent to the political prison was the best it could happen to them. So, through a perfect alignment of factors and characters, we are in April 1974, and the military simply has had enough. Rebel captains and soldiers are organizing a coup to topple the regime and bring democracy back to Portugal. It unfolded in two stages, thanks to two secret signals played out on the national radio. The first signal came at 10:55 p.m. on the 24th of April. One of the revolutionaries worked at the national broadcaster and was in charge of playing a very specific song at that time, which would indicate rebel captains and soldiers across the country to leave their barracks and begin the coup. They had to choose a song that wasn't suspicious. So what better than Portugal's entry to the Eurovision Song Contest? The singer Paulo de Carvalho and the song E Depois do Adeus. And so, just 18 days after the final of the Eurovision Song Contest, Portugal's entry had its chance to shine again. The second signal came at 12:20 a.m. with another song, this time telling the rebels in the military to take control of strategic positions of power across the country. The Carnation Revolution was in full motion. Hours later, the government surrendered and the fascist regime came to an end. Paulo de Carvalho's song is completely apolitical. It's a love ballad talking about the end of a relationship. So it is quite ironic that a song about a breakup leads to the fall of one of Europe's longest dictatorships. There's a lesson here, and a reminder that even if you come last in a competition, the future might have other plans for you. For Monocle 24, I'm Carlota Rebello.
Carlota Rebello on how Eurovision helped, well, sort of, overthrow a dictator. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Monocle's senior correspondent and Monocle 24's Eurovision desk chief. And we're also joined now by Lance Price, former director of communications at number 10 Downing Street. Lance, I will start with you as somebody who obviously has an amount of experience and expertise in politics and projection and how image can aid with both of those things. Does any of this Eurovision stuff actually matter?
I think it does matter. In Britain, we try to pretend that it doesn't, but that's mainly because we keep losing. But I think for a lot of countries, it matters enormously. And don't forget, it's the biggest global entertainment brand, one of them certainly, in the world. It's the most watched annual entertainment show of any kind, I mean, sporting events included, on an annual basis. And it has a reach across the globe. I mean, it's extraordinary how many people tune in to watch it. And even if some of those people don't take it too seriously, there's no doubt that both financially and to a degree politically, and I'm sure we'll come on to that, yeah, it does matter.
Fernando, given everything that Lance has just said there, is it not the case that Eurovision's official determination that the contest be completely free of politics, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
To be honest, Andrew, it's never really completely with no politics at all. I mean, they try their best because they don't want to offend many European countries. And as Lance was saying, it's big business. They can't do anything wrong. But look at, for example, the winning song from Ukraine just a few years ago, Jamala with 1944. Quite a political song. Was talking about the deportation of the Crimean Tatars by the Soviet Union, but for some reason it did manage to go through. But for example, do you remember Georgia's entry? We don't want put in. We don't want to put in. The negative move is killing the crew. I'ma try to shut in some disco tonight. Boogie with you.
You see what they did there.
Exactly. That has to be banned because perhaps it was a bit too direct. So there's always politics when it comes to LGBT representation. Some countries in Europe are so conservative. I mean, it's still very much illegal almost to be gay. So I think the event is political, but of course they have to ban a few things here and there.
Lance, is there a case that if you are trying to make a political statement that Eurovision is kind of all the more potent an arena to do it in precisely because it does everything it can to keep it from being political? I mean, if it was just a contest where everybody turned up actually encouraged to express their historical grievances and regional hatreds, which, by the way, I for one would watch the hell out of, such gestures as you are able to make don't have as much impact, do they?
No, but I think because of the size of it, the scale of it, and the fact that people are watching it for entertainment, and therefore if you can get a political message in there as well, then you may be reaching people who otherwise wouldn't be listening. So there's no doubt at all that people have in the past and will continue to try to use it for political purposes. I mean, if you remember, I think it was 2005 that Lebanon were going to join. And they realised that they had to show Israel's entry and they couldn't opt out of it when the broadcast was made. And so they pulled out altogether. Politics runs through everything. Politics is my life. I understand that. And for some people, it's regrettable and uncomfortable and it's kind of spoils the fun. It's never going to go away altogether.
Fernando, does it strike you when there is some sort of brouhaha, if you will, about Eurovision because somebody has got upset about something? Do you think the offence is genuine or is there a certain amount of theatrics in play here?
I believe it's both. I mean, there are a lot of theatrics here, but we are seeing even this year, for example, the Belarusian song has been banned. And I do think a lot of people here in Europe, they're taking this quite seriously about everything that's happening to the country. And they don't want a song that is pro-government. So in a way, I do think it's a mix of both.
Lance, do you have a particular favourite example of somebody attempting to leverage Eurovision to make a serious point about anything?
Well, I suppose the one that we most remember, of course, is Madonna, who got into terrible trouble at Eurovision for two reasons. One, it showed that she was terrible at trying to perform live and she really bombed. But also she tried to wave the Palestinian flag, and in fact did. And you know, whoever advised her to do that, I think, was probably very ill-advised.
That said, and it's getting us off topic a little bit, but your dissing of Madonna there, I mean, the expression of rage that contorted Fernando's face at that particular moment was a terrifying, terrifying sight to behold. And Lance, I am trapped here in a studio with him, so I will caution you both to try and keep your own controversies out of the rest of our discussion.
Even gods and goddesses, Fernando, have bad days.
That's true. I was there. I have to say, the performance was not the usual greatness of Madonna. I have to admit.
We are, I fear, on the verge of drifting from the point here. So I will ask you, Fernando, if we look at this from the point of view of the host nation, do you think it is a good opportunity for nation building or national image building, I should say?
I think it's a great opportunity for a nation's soft power. I sometimes base my image of a country of their kind of relationship with Eurovision. Sweden, for example, and I was lucky. I've been covering, you know, Eurovision for Monaco for years now, and I've been to, I believe, 7 of them. And 2 of them were in Sweden. And I have to say, that's the country where I have the most fun covering. They are a powerhouse when it comes to music. So I think Eurovision is also very important to them as well. And another thing, Andrew, some people say, oh, everybody's singing in English. But sometimes even singing your song, it's a nice way to represent your country. Look at Portugal. They won with the beautiful ballad by Salvador Sobral. Very difficult ballad. I didn't expect it to win, in fact, but it was a Portuguese ballad and it won. Or even Serbia in 2007 when Maria Serifovic won with Molitva. You wouldn't imagine a song like this to win, but it did. And I think some people say, oh, I might learn Serbian or I might learn Portuguese. Who knows?
Lance, at which point we do need to consider the curious state that the United Kingdom finds itself in where Eurovision is concerned. The United Kingdom, arguably more than any other country on earth, has an absolutely impeccable pop music heritage and yet cannot buy a win or even a decent showing at Eurovision. Do you believe that the United Kingdom is actually salvageable as a Eurovision contender?
I mean, I would just point out on a party political basis that the last time the United Kingdom won the Eurovision Song Contest was in 1997, just after Tony Blair had been elected Prime Minister. But we'll let that one go. Of course, it's salvageable. I think we are starting to take it more seriously. And actually, if you look into the history of Eurovision, the United Kingdom has been absolutely seminal in bringing it forward. So we used to win really quite frequently when it was a much smaller competition. But I think it was in 1998, it was the UK in Birmingham who really turned it into an extravaganza on the scale that it has since become. And I think in the process, does it really matter whether we win or lose? It's great entertainment. It's good for the music. Every Briton knows that our music industry and our creativity is an awful lot better than what we tend to put up on Eurovision.
Fernando, one of the reasons that does get advanced for the United Kingdom's serial failures in recent years is the phenomenon of the block vote, that there are countries that do have an advantage because all their neighbours vote for them. Infamously, Greece and Cyprus almost always trade top marks. The Scandinavian countries often help each other out, ditto the countries of the former Yugoslavia. Although, weirdly, the United Kingdom often gets a counter-historical bump from the Republic of Ireland. My question to you about block voting, it is objectively hilarious, isn't it?
It is hilarious, but I have to say, Andrew, there are ways to escape the block voting. I genuinely believe if the song is special, I think it doesn't matter. And they are trying to deal a little bit more of block voting. Since a few years now, half of the vote is by the jury, half of the vote is by televoting. And sometimes they go on completely different ways. We were talking about the Polish entry from 2014, the Milkmaids one. The jury, I think, put it last in the televoting number one, and it ended at number 14 in the end. So you have to attract the jury, the televoting, and everyone.
There's kind of a wider point there, though, I think, Lance, about the block voting phenomenon, that there is something weirdly heartwarming about it, people looking out for their neighbours, helping each other out, and so forth. Is there anything at all to the idea of this somewhat frivolous song contest as nevertheless some pillar of European identity?
That was the original idea behind it. It was there to bring the countries of Europe together culturally. And I think it has a lot of success with that. The very fact that so many people do tune in and that even after all this time, you think how long it's been going, that it's still something that a lot of us still put in our diaries and make sure that we're in for and we get the booze in. Politically, I would never defend the block vote, but in terms of the way it works in Eurovision, it's not quite as cynical as you make it sound, because if you look at the former Yugoslavia, for example, those countries were at war with each other. They vote for each other out of cultural reasons as much as anything else, and maybe the same for us in Ireland.
Fernando, as you and our regular listeners will know, this programme, The Foreign Desk, is a forum for the rigorous discussion of the issues that actually matter. And there is one about Eurovision that we do need to discuss, which is that in recent years, in order to stop the actual song contest from going on for about 9 hours, they do weed out some of the more outre contenders with pre-final semi-finals. Now, can we agree that this is nonsense? Because it ends up depriving us of what's usually the fun part of the Eurovision Song Contest, or used to be, which is just the absolutely insane, inexplicable entry from some country that has somehow ended up winning their national competition for reasons surpassing understanding.
I mean, you're very right. There's some quite wacky entries that we're not going to be able to see at the final. It is a shame, Andrew, but at the same time, it does make business sense because the show is quite long with 26 acts. I mean, if they have 39, I wouldn't mind. I genuinely wouldn't mind to have quite a few drinks and enjoy myself like for a very, very long night. But in terms of advertising and all sorts of reasons, they kind of had to do it. Eurovision expanded. Even your own country entered in 2015. So now it's becoming longer and longer now.
My own country did enter in 2015 and has been cruelly robbed every year ever since. It is an outrage. But on that thought, we are coming towards the part of the programme, i.e. the end of it, in which I'm going to have to ask you both for your tip for the 2021 Eurovision Song Contest. Lance, I will come to you first. First, who do you like at this distance?
Malta seems to be the favourite. I quite fancy Italy.
Lance,
I think Italy could do very well this year. Let's see.
Okay, Italy, possibly Malta from Lance there, Fernando?
I agree with Lance on Malta. Surprised that he picked Italy. It was quite a left-field track, I would say, for Italy. But my heart says Lithuania with the Roop discotheque.
Explain, why do you think Lithuania might be the tip? I should let our listeners know at this point that I have made money from Fernando's tips in previous years. This might be worth hearing.
I think we need an upbeat track, and just look at the name, discotheque. Let's discotheque right at my... There's amazing choreography involved, and they wear some amazing yellow suits as well. I think that conquered my heart.
Disco, choreography, and yellow suits.
Yes.
It sounds like a winner. Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lance Price, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Emma also produced this week's Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks for listening. Playing us out this week, Lithuania's own The Roop with Discotheque.